This is Edwin K. Morris, and you are about to embark on the next Pioneer Knowledge Services Because You Need to Know, a digital resource for you to listen to folks share their experience and knowledge around the field of knowledge management and nonprofit work. If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email bynTK@pioneer-ks.org.
My name is David Gertin. I live in England. I live in a little town called Fleet, which is, I guess, about 30 miles southwest of London. One of my favorite spots that's maybe about 10 miles away is an old abbey. It's called Waverley Abbey. It was the first Cistercian abbey in England and unfortunately got pretty much decimated by our good King Henry VIII. But what's fascinating about the abbey, there's still some quite substantial remains of the abbey, but there's a small river that runs by it, and alongside the river there are a large number of so-called dragon's teeth, and a lot of people might know these. They are still in use today, but they were mainly used in the Second World War to deter tanks. They're big triangular concrete blocks that tanks have difficulty getting over. When I first went there, I thought, well, what's a tank trap doing in the middle of the Hampshire countryside? Before you come to the abbey, in fact, the car park where you park the car, there is a Second World War pillbox, quite a substantial one. And so for a long time, I had no idea what was there. Then interestingly, I had a conversation with an Australian military gentleman who explained to me, oh, he says, it's a killing field. Those dragon teeth would have been either side of the river. Metal chains would have been strung across the river to force tanks out of the river into this large field, and there would have been an anti-tank gun the other side of the field to knock out the tanks. And I thought, well, this is the middle of the English countryside. What's it doing here? A little bit of Googling, and I discovered that during the Second World War, there was a line, a defensive line called the HQ line, that ran totally around London. It was a series of tank traps, series of pillboxes to prevent or deter a German invasion coming up from the south coast. So the idea is that the German tanks would come up from the south coast, they would come to this river, they would try to cross the river, they would be forced out of the river by the tiger teeth, some little men in a pillbox would knock out the tanks. Thank goodness it never happened. That's one of the most interesting places that's close to where I live. This kind of makes a connection for me, because one of the things I feel about myself, or one of the questions I always ask myself, is why am I who I am? And I've had a long life now, so I've got a lot of past to look over and a lot of things to think about. You know, what made me who I am? And a big part of who I am is my curiosity. I've always been incredibly curious. So again, those tiger teeth, they piqued my curiosity. I took the time to figure out exactly what they were. But the question is, why am I so curious? And I can't necessarily pinpoint this, but there's one little story that goes way back to my childhood. I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. One winter evening, my father took me into our back garden. It was a clear night, beautiful starry night, and he pointed out the stars to me. He pointed out the constellations, and he knew them well because he fought in the African desert in the Second World War. In fact, he was actually captured by the Germans at the first battle of El Alamein. So I say, he knew the constellations well, so he showed me the constellations. And this could be a false memory, but I'm pretty sure part of a little conversation we had, he said, he explained to me that the stars were distant suns like our sun. And he explained that possibly there could be planets around some of those distant suns. And just maybe on one of those planets, there were father and son looking up in the sky, having a conversation just like we were. I say, I think that could be a false memory, but I would swear that we had that conversation. Mm. And so that got me extremely interested, basically, in where we came from and the origins of the universe. And so I studied physics at university, and my first job was with British Aerospace, and an aerospace company. I wanted to help build things to go to the moon. So I think it was that piqued my curiosity all those years ago.
And do you have an age? Do you have an age guess how old you were?
7 or 8. I can pinpoint that by the house we were living in. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of interesting because it was a conversation. Mm. And it's something you were saying earlier about how conversations live on in your head.
Yes.
And I think that little conversation, the thought of the father and son on another planet.
No kidding.
That stuck with me.
That creativity and search for answers, being inquisitive and having the awareness to ask questions. Not everybody has that skill set to, one, be aware enough to know. Go back to your dragon teeth concept. How many people look at those and wonder what that is, but they don't spend any energy trying to figure out what it is, and they don't ask anybody, right? They forget about it, and it's not important. But you make things important enough to understand them.
Exactly.
Yeah?
Exactly.
So tell me what human trait that builds that capacity.
That's a question that's on my mind a lot. Because if you think about the world and you think about the problems that we face, we need more people who are curious, who are going to question everything, because there's so much that's good in the world, but there's so much that's wrong in the world as well. We need that curiosity. It seems to me that curiosity drives so much in what it is to be human. I say it's a question that's been with me. Mm-hmm. How do you train? How do you educate? I don't like train, educate. How do you educate people? I'm not too sure even like educate. How do you encourage? How do you create an environment where, I guess, children, but even adults, are more curious?
The environment has to be, one, safe for someone to put themselves out there.
Yep.
And if that parent, just change your paradigm, if you just went back to that 7-year-old kid and that experience would have been to a negative degree, reverse the story, flip the story. And say, oh, my dad said, he started saying, we're going to all die and it doesn't matter. And, if the experience would have been to the negative, then that imprint would have been to the negative.
Yeah, it may well have been fair.
This came up in a recent conversation about the definition of art. Now, in this story I was hearing from a fella, he was saying that he wanted to bring this skill to his grandkids, right? He wanted to impart, similar to what your story is here, he wanted to leave them a positive story about, he's a general contractor, he's a builder, but he wants to build a workshop with the grandchildren just to make wind instruments, musical instruments. So I was like, I was listening to that. I said, well, then I pulled up this definition of art. Well, by definition, you're an artist. So the art of creativity is something that you can instill or at least example for someone else to say and change their mindset, right? Change their filters. This definition of art sticks with me because it covers everything. It covers everything you're just talking about. Art is the conscious use of skill and creative imagination, especially in the production of aesthetic objects. So if we think of language as an object, you could argue either way, but I think language is an object. It becomes an imaginational thing, right? When I tell you the table's red, you know what a table is, the color red. So there's an objectification in language that crosses a threshold from me to you. And it's just by you hearing the words. And now I've transferred an image. It may be an incorrect image, as we all know, that just because I say it doesn't mean you hear it because of filters and things like that. But in the work you do, which is around installing the creative, artistic conversations. The design is to do what out of the work you're focused on? What is the output of these conversations?
I think a conversation can have many different purposes. It could be to explore an issue. It could be to solve a problem. It could be to explore an issue. It could be to build a relationship. There are many different purposes. I've just been reading a book entitled The History of Conversation, and I've forgotten exactly who it is in there. They make the point that I've forgotten the philosopher, but he was traveling the highlands of Scotland, and he said in his memoirs or his diary, in the Scottish Highlands, there was much talk, but no conversation. And for him, conversation had no purpose. The value in the conversation was actually the conversation itself. If you were talking about politics, or if you were deciding which village to visit next or what have you, for him, that was talk, but it wasn't a conversation. A conversation is maybe a little bit like what we're having now. In some ways, the conversation we're having, there isn't a particular purpose. There isn't a particular script. There isn't a particular planned outcome. The conversation is going to take us wherever the conversation takes us. People get, for whatever reason, get immense pleasure from that.
Yeah.
You know, I run the Knowledge Cafes, and people, by and large, love the Knowledge Cafes. I've never had one go significantly wrong. But if you try to pinpoint exactly what it is about the cafe that makes it so so enjoyable, it's very difficult. Usually there's no consensus on anything. there's no agreement. There's no outcome. But
does that end up being the outcome? At least
the outcomes.
It didn't end up in a fist fight and nobody threw their coffee at the wall. And, you know.
It's the conversation. It's the enjoyment is in the conversation itself, not even particularly about the content or the outcome.
I think most people would say not everybody they want to have a conversation with.
No.
Not everyone. You're like, oh, geez. You know, you see them coming down the street and you're like, I'm going to duck in the store for a minute. Because either they dominate, they don't have a conversation, they just fill up space.
As soon as somebody starts to become judgmental or starts to become critical about anything, and it's clear they are not going to even accept the fact that there could be a different point of view, as you say, there is no conversation.
Yeah.
It stops there.
Yeah.
It's you're listening to a monologue, you're listening to a lecture, you're listening to
a
speech.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's not particularly enjoyable.
I'll give you a story. I was working in the federal space in the U.S. Army as a contractor, and I'd just taken this new position, and I was being shown around the office and introductions and all that jazz. And there was this big guy that came walking up and just started talking. Got a quick introduction. The woman that was doing the intros for me, in the midst of his sentence, put her hand in his face, like, stop. And just turned and walked away. And I was like, wow, that was rude. But it didn't take long to see that is the only way you could peel yourself away from that guy, because he just, you didn't have any conversation with you. He just, it was almost like he didn't even want a conversation. He just wanted to offload all this stuff.
That's right, yes. I've got a saying that I've run some cafes around this and written about it. We are not enemies, but friends. And the whole idea of this is that if somebody comes to me with a very different opinion of some issue, and you know it could be an issue that's important to me, I don't want to see that person as an enemy. Mm. Here's somebody that's got a different view on the world.
Mm-hmm.
They're a friend. Here's maybe, I can maybe learn something from this person, or maybe they can learn something from me. Now, that is dependent on having a dialogue rather than a debate.
Yes.
If you've got two people who come together with very different views and they're prepared to have a dialogue, they're prepared to have a conversation, then there's so much value in that. We shouldn't, you know, especially in politics, we shouldn't be seeing each other as enemies.
Well, that would be great. How do we fix that, David? How do we address that? I know England is, you know, pretty calm when it comes to their politics versus the United States.
Well,
but
I'm not so sure at times. I I think somehow it's got to go back to education, to childhood. Mm. We talk a lot in education about literacy and numeracy, you know, so literacy, the ability to read and write, numeracy, the ability to handle numbers. There's another word, and that's odyssey, which hardly ever gets mentioned. And
say it again.
Odyssey, O-R-A-C-Y, odyssey. You don't know the word? No, I didn't know the word until a few years ago. And I think the word was invented in the 60s. So odyssey is the ability fundamentally to listen and to talk. Obviously, it's fundamentally about the ability to have a good conversation. And actually, in some schools in England, it is actually taught.
Oh, my good God.
Yeah.
Why do I not know this word? Why don't I know this word? Well, it's a British English word. That's why. That's one reason. It didn't make it across the pond. Merriam-Webster's definition is proficiency in oral expression and comprehension. Mm-hmm. Those are two independent parts that don't always commingle in a person's brain. There's those that just blah, blah, blah. But the comprehension requires reflection. Comprehension requires building concepts and understanding and hopefully some empathy, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting, interesting.
But you think about it, it's not taught in schools.
Gosh, what was it? So I'm gonna guess back in my dad's era, my mom and dad's era. They were both born in 1925. So their primary school would have been a one-room schoolhouse. At least my dad's case was that. So they were in a one-room schoolhouse. And this is one thing that was obvious to me is that because of the type of schooling they had, they were in almost an intergenerational space because you had all grades. You had old kids and young kids all in the same schoolhouse.
Yes.
I think there was probably some unintentional learning of comprehension that since then we don't have that experience. Because now you're separated. You're separated by age. But interesting. So, the comprehension, I think, is, well, I mean, you might as well call it critical thinking. I mean, that's the common term in the military. Well, where's your critical thinking?
It's interesting you mentioned critical thinking, because let's pick up on another issue here. Often when we see people who maybe harbor crazy ideas, conspiracy theories and what have you, one of the standard responses is that we need to teach children to be better critical thinkers. Now, that only goes so far. All the psychological research pretty much shows that on most issues, and in particular, you know, moral issues and political issues, we are not rational. you're with me. we have an opinion. An instant opinion on
everything,
and that has, I guess, been formed over the experience of our lives. We express that opinion, and then if somebody asks us why we have that opinion, we post-rationalize. We then look, we struggle to find explanations as to why we believe that particular issue. Now, what the research shows is that people who are better critical thinkers are better at post-rationalizing.
So they're clearer in their comprehension of, so what you're saying is that they're just better argument makers, or they're substantiators of their argument.
They are better argument makers, yes. Yeah.
So the definition, just to get clear on this, the definition of critical thinking is the objective analysis and evaluation of an issue in order to form a judgment. Before I looked that up, I was thinking, the synonym to me of critical thinking would be common sense. You know, the old, you just need some common sense. But in this definition, it's not common sense, because this is not common. This framework, the analysis, evaluation to form a judgment, that's more process. That's like a process you have to follow.
Let's say a little bit more here. If you look at the way individually, the way that we reason, the way that we make sense of the world, I think if you go to Wikipedia, there are like 200 cognitive biases in Wikipedia, all sorts of ways that, all sorts of flaws, well, actually, they're not flaws, but let's call them flaws for now, all sorts of flaws in our thinking. So individually, we are not terribly good at reasoning. which seems kind of strange. You would have thought that evolution would have, you know, shaped us a little better. But
I think we got the fire hot. You know, we got that part. But other than that,
we got that part. But if you look at reasoning, not as an individual capability, but as a social capability, you think of reasoning as being social, then it takes on a whole different light, because you have formed your opinion without really evaluating the evidence. I've formed my opinion, a different one, a very different one, without evaluating the evidence. Other people will all have different opinions that have been formed with very little evidence. Now bring those people together in conversation to start to, and maybe use some critical thinking to start to evaluate those different points of view. We are much better at that than doing it on our own. Far, far better at it, indeed.
So what you're saying is collaboration is easy then?
Not easy. Okay. Right. Not easy. because
that's why everything that's run by a committee just goes so much better, because everybody's got a hand in it.
You know, you need people to come together and be open-minded. If they're just going to come together and stick to their ideology, their dogma, and fight, which is what the politicians seem to do, we're not going to get anywhere. But if you come to the conversation having recognized that as individuals we are biased and we get things wrong, and that we need other people with different opinions to bounce those ideas off, then there's a chance that we might just make better sense of the world and make better decisions.
That requires listening.
Yes.
So out of all the discussion that we've just had, we have not hit upon the secret sauce, which is you have to be a participant in the engagement of conversation, which implies that you'll be listening. And that's where we've lost a lot of this social understanding. You bring it into a social context. Mm-hmm. Society has got an issue, because now we've gone to the digital soapbox, and now everybody's on their digital soapbox spouting whatever, based off of whatever. You know, you talked about supporting your argument with evidence. Well, everybody's got their own evidence now, so everybody's right. Everybody's right in their mind, because, oh, well, this says this, and that's, you know.
You can take any issue, and if you've made up your mind on the issue and you go to the web to look for evidence, you can find it. Whatever.
Oh, so it's a scientific approach. Oh, yes. So where do we create the space for society to have a conversation?
There are a lot of people and a lot of organizations organizing conversations. As you know, I do it through my knowledge cafes. Mm-hmm. But there are Benjamin Franklin had his Junto Club, where he brought, okay, in those days it was men, but he brought men together to have conversations around local social issues. In London, in the 17th and 18th century, there were the coffee houses of London. That out of those coffee houses came tremendous innovation. Lloyd's of London, the Royal Society. There were many innovations that came out of those. Out of those coffee houses in Paris, the salons of Paris were well-to-do women and well-to-do people actually together to have all sorts of conversations, be they political or philosophical. So it's creating those spaces for genuine conversation.
You know, it's always inspiring when I learn stuff, and maybe we talked about this Junto Club before. According to this, when Benjamin Franklin was the age of 21.
Yeah.
He created the Junto Club. Now, I have to wonder, knowing that this is based in inspiration, you know, as an inventor and a thinker, big thinker kind of guy that he was, do you think it was very open to everybody to be there?
No. Oh, no, absolutely not. Well, I say that. I mean, there certainly weren't any women in his Junto Club.
Okay.
He did have a mix. I mean, I know there was a runaway student from Oxford. There was a carpenter. They were. Well,
let me go on to the detail. It was made up of a diverse group, including printers, surveyors, cabinet maker, a clerk, and a bartender.
Yep.
So he made sure the drinks were flowing, I guess.
So what he had there was some cognitive diversity for sure.
You betcha. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
I think it was the Library of Philadelphia came out of that junto club, because books in those days were very expensive, and they were usually shipped over from England. The house that they met in, they put a room aside where they deposited their personal books in that room so they could share them amongst themselves. But later, they opened that room up to the public. It was one of the...
Yeah, I think it goes on to talk about the Library Company of Philadelphia. First lending library in the United States. You're right. But I want to talk about, he calls them the four pledges. Something I think humanity needs to hear, and it's Benjamin Franklin's autobiography is the credit, but this is the quote. Our debates were to be conducted in the sincere spirit of inquiry after truth, without fondness for dispute or desire for victory.
Exactly.
We need a little of that. Where's that guy? You know, where?
Yeah, no, he did have a set of rules. I've forgotten the rules now, but I think he had five principles.
Yeah.
They were fundamentally about the pursuit of truth and about openness. In fact, they weren't rules, they were pledges. Remember, had to pledge.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. I love this. This is awesome. And this is going to come in very handy in the near future. So thank you very much for that.
Now, there are people today who create their own junto clubs. There are modern day junto clubs. And there are also things called Jefferson dinners. It seems Jefferson used to bring people together to have conversation over dinner. I know less about that, but in history, there've been a lot of different ways that people have come together to have, shall we say, meaningful conversation.
Yes. Those meaningful conversations, yes.
And that's what we need more of.
Everybody's on their monologue. Everybody's on their flag-waving mantras. And it's like, oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Can we stop this nonsense?
There's a lovely story. I keep meaning to write something about it. Let's see if I can remember the details. This was a Muslim MP. I think she was the first Muslim MP in, I think, Denmark. And she used to get masses of hate mail, really nasty vitriol. And for some reason, she kept it all. It didn't seem to affect her too much, but she kept it all. And one day, she was telling a friend about it. And the friend said, well, why don't you talk to them? So she went back. Crazy idea.
Why would I do that?
She went back to her email archive. She found the one man who had been, you know, the most persistent, most sort of nastiest troll. She found him, I think, on Facebook, on the web in some way, actually found his phone number and phoned him up and said, would you like to invite me for tea? And he accepted. And she actually went to his house, which seems incredibly brave, and had tea and a conversation. Now, she said they came away from that. They didn't agree on anything, but they had a civil conversation over their differences. I must look that up, because I would have hoped that maybe she would have said a little bit more about what they agreed and disagreed on and just quite how that conversation went. But the fact that she did that...
It is brave, is what it is.
It's quite amazing.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd have done that.
Brave, yes, incredibly brave.
So on the Jefferson Dinner website, it's a .org, so I'm assuming this is a nonprofit around this whole concept, and it details how to do a Jefferson Dinner. But they have a quote here from Thomas Jefferson that says, I never considered a difference of opinion in politics, in religion, in philosophy, as a cause for withdrawing from a friend.
Absolutely. Comes back to my friends, not enemies quote again. And that came from your president. Civil War president.
Abraham Lincoln.
Lincoln, of course. Lincoln, yes. This quotation about being friends, not enemies, I think is in his inauguration speech as president. He referred to
it. Yeah, we need a little more of that instead of the defensive posture in attacking everything. I don't know how to retract it, though. I don't know how to pull that back.
But, you see, if we could understand or accept that the way the human brain works, the way that human reasoning works, is that we do jump to a conclusion without evidence and then retrofit the evidence. If we can accept that about ourselves, then it's so much easier to talk to somebody who's got a different opinion.
There's hope.
Yeah.
There's hope. Maybe it's age, and maybe it's the current situation of such in the last 7 years or so in current United States. Maybe it's a combination of things, but what Thomas Jefferson's talking about and Benjamin Franklin sounds like a lot of work. Sounds like way too much work to bridge the gap. There's part of me that says that. The other part of me says that we go back to what we talked about when somebody is just a machine of monologue. I have more issue with the machine monologue than opposing concepts, opposing opinion. So for me, it's a boundary issue. There are certain elements in our political structure. I just don't have time for any of that. And I don't want to listen to anybody that's spouting that stuff. It's against the grain for me. It's
a very different mindset. These are people who see, they actually see conversation as a battle. They see it as a war. And of course, in war, basically anything goes. Do have a certain amount of morality these days in wars, but basically in war, there is no morality. You can say anything you want. That the whole essence of war is winning. And that's what so much politics has come down to.
Let's get off that light subject and wrap things up with a... We were doing so well. I think the challenge to put out there for everybody is have a Jefferson dinner and start a Junto Club and get some conversation cooking in your own backyard. So the common term 40, 50 years ago was a NIMBY, right?
Yep, okay.
Not in my backyard. I don't care about saving the planet. Just don't mess up my kitchen space in the backyard. But the challenge to, and this is a societal challenge, has nothing to do with race, creed, religion, none of that stuff. It is this tribalism that we need. This seems to be an antidote for that.
I think it is. I mean, I suspect we're never going to totally get away from our tribal nature. That seems to go very deep. I think what's positive and what's optimistic about this is, you know, when it comes to having real conversations, each and every one of us, has, if we choose to, has got the ability to do that. It's kind of a mindset thing. It's just seeing things a little differently and recognizing, you know, that most of the time we're not right. Mm-hmm. If we want to learn, if we want to make better decisions, if we want to understand the world better, hey, the way we do that is through a conversation where someone's going to challenge it, is going to challenge our views. I mean, interestingly, I had a conversation with somebody the other day. For the first time, really, we had a difference of opinion, and I asked them why they thought the way that they did. And it was obvious to me that they were struggling to give me, you know, rational reasons as to why they thought the way they did. Maybe in the past, I would have thought them stupid. Maybe I would have argued with them. But I realized that they were doing what we all do. They had an opinion, and they were trying desperately to rationalize it. And at the same time, I realized that I do exactly the same. It's not that I'm any better than them. We're both doing the same.
Well, the difference is that you
if we understand
you were right and he was wrong. See, that's the difference.
But if you can get away from the right and wrong.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, what's David Gertine's definition of knowledge management today?
Oh, my God. Having good conversations. There you go.
Perfect.
Having better conversations.
All right. I'll take that.
That's what I'm doing with conversational leadership. It's about, fundamentally, at its root, it's about having better conversations.
Now, going back to Benjamin Franklin's
Junto.
He's got a prescription that sets boundaries, you know, back to your idea of the pledges,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
In another line of work I was working in, they set the container. These are the rules of the container.
The rules,
right?
Yes.
You've got to have an operating system in which to to operate in.
Yes.
And everybody's got to say yes or no. And if you're saying no, then boom, you're not in this conversation.
What she's got there is five pledges. I've written something about a covenant, and I've got something like 10 pledges. Okay. So, you know, they're simple things. Like, again, no ad hominem attacks is an obvious one, because as soon as you do that, there's no conversation. Nope. Conversing in good faith, you know, tell the truth as best you can. If you are trying to deceive the other person, you're trying to lie, it's not a conversation. Nope. It's not too difficult to actually define those rules and agree those rules. You think about a game of, you call it soccer, we call it football. Imagine a game like that without any rules.
Any rules, yeah.
You know exactly what's going to happen to put the ball in the goal.
Well, and that procedural method, and what is it? Robert's Rules? Is that what I'm thinking?
Yes. Yeah, I know the ones you mean.
It's a sequential understanding of what has to happen for things to happen in this conversation that they're having. So what you're doing is you're just really laying down the baseline so everybody agrees to how they will behave. And we're talking behavior, just people and how they behave. And if you don't have that agreement,
if you behavior.
Don't have that agreement, then
there is no conversation.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult, but actually. Well, it is and it isn't. Yes.
It's not.
Conceptually, it isn't that difficult.
Yeah. It's like, I know I'm supposed to drink 8 glasses of water a day. I know that. Do I do it? You know. But the common sense part of this says that every meeting, every organizational meeting, every conversation should adopt some methodology that gives this protection. I use the word protection, but it creates a safe operating system.
Amy Edmondson, you know, calls psychological safety. Mm. In fact, that's exactly what, when I talk about the covenant that I talk about it creating psychological safety. So actually, it's more than psychological safety, isn't it? It's, you're not going to have a creative conversation if you don't have that safety.
Why am I going to put this out there if I'm just going to get stepped on? If there's always this defensive with somebody in the group, then more people are quiet. They don't participate. They don't engage. They're cautious.
It's interesting. Theodore Zeldin has a wonderful quotation. There's a wonderful quotation I often quote, a lot of people quote, from his little book on conversation from 20-odd years ago. And that's where he says, the kind of conversation that I like is where we're prepared to emerge a slightly different person. Mm-hmm. Now, my version of it is the kind of conversation I like is one where I don't feel the need to censor anything that I say. I can say anything, you know, within a small group with safety. And if I do say anything that's politically incorrect or sexist or what have you, the other person knows me well enough to kind of laugh at me and say, David, you know, do you realize what you just said was politically incorrect or that was sexist? And I'd say, oh yeah, okay, you know, I didn't choose my words terribly well.
Yeah. But
if they're going to jump down my throat and accuse me of something that is just a slip of the tongue, which we always make, again, there is no conversation. You just want to be able to speak your mind without having to, at times, necessarily choose your words too carefully. Now, you can't do that publicly, especially you're a public figure.
Depends if you're a president or not, maybe you can.
Well,
but, so, as you were describing that, the word intimate came into mind, because an intimate space has presumably a level of mutual trust, mutual understanding.
Yes, exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah.
Most conversations you would not apply the word intimate to, because they're not. They're not of the kind you were just describing. Maybe there we should put out to the world that you should create an intent to build some intimate conversations.
I'd go along with that.
So you could feel heard.
And they are intimate conversations, then they really are, because if you don't feel, you know, fearful in the conversation, you know that you can make yourself vulnerable. You can share things with people that maybe you wouldn't share with anyone else. Maybe you've never shared with anybody in your life, because you know that they're not going to attack you, they're not going to judge you, that they're not going to breach your privacy. Then you can have some really, really intimate conversations.
Well, now, I mean, we just stepped into the whole concept of counseling, right?
I guess.
With a counselor is that you want to create that space that you can share in a safe place.
Yeah.
Things that you may have never said to anybody else because you're afraid of repercussions or you're afraid of being judged. One of the things in the definition of intimate is belonging to or characterizing one's deepest nature.
Okay.
That's exactly what we've been talking about, is to have that level of, I'll say the word fidelity, having that level of fidelity in a conversation of that level. That's where super meaning comes from, because see if you agree with this. So the idea of open thinking or talking your way through a thought helps in some degree, because once you think it, that's one way you hear it in your head. But when you say it, it gives energy to it, and it may not sound the same as it did inside your cranium. So it's always good to talk things through. You know, I'll give you a case in point, like proofreading. This is a simple concept.
Okay, yeah.
You know, when you're writing an email, or you're writing us whatever, you're writing some composition, what you type and what the brain says you're saying, once you hear it, it sounds different.
Yes.
It impacts you differently. So in proofreading, it's great to just read it out loud, because it may not sound the same as you're writing it.
What's even better, and I've forgotten, I started to do this and I've dropped out of the habit. If I'm writing something, an article, it's really important that I get the tone and everything right. I use the playback feature, the web.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Somebody else speaks it and I listen to it. I do that a few days later and I sit back and I close my eyes and I listen. And as you say, it's very different.
It's different. It's not what I was thinking. You're like, wow, what did I write that?
Yeah, and you spot the flaws in your logic, and you spot the gaps as well, where you jump from one thing to another without explaining the connection.
Yeah, I'm classic for that. I jump tracks all the time.
We all do.
My wife reads it and she's like, "What the hell are you saying here?" You know, it's like, you know, and I fill in the gaps, and she's like, "Well, you need to write that part, because you just jumped the track."
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, my friend. It has been very enlightening. You've taught me a lot, as usual, and I wish you the best, and I want to hear more of what's going on in the world next time we have you here.
Let's do this again in another 18 months. It will be fun to do. I've immensely enjoyed it. Thank you, Edwin. Thank you.
You betcha. You have just finished our latest Because You Need to Know, a public service of Pioneer Knowledge Services. Please join us on LinkedIn and find us at pioneer-ks.org. Company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email bynTK@pioneer-ks.org.